We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics. Joining me today is Keith Weiner. Keith is the president of the Gold Standard Institute of the USA, CEO of Monetary Metals, and also holds a PhD in economics. Thanks for joining me today, Keith.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So, Keith, you were recently on a big trip around the world, spanning from the US to Istanbul, Dubai, Singapore, and Australia, with many stops in between. And I wanted to start by talking a little bit about if you found that there were big differences in attitude towards gold in those places versus the West in general, let's say Western Europe and the US.
Yeah, absolutely. Number one, there's the level of activity in the gold market and, you know, trading volumes off the charts in the Middle East compared to here. You just wouldn't get a sense of it here. You know, right now, gold's kind of not moribund, but nobody's really excited. They're waiting for the next, you know, bit. They think that, you know, because we have rising interest rates, that means necessarily a softer gold price. They should look at Monetary Metals. Some years ago, published a chart. I think it was one of our gold market outlooks for one of the annual reports that we do, looking at is there a correlation between the gold price and interest rates, either nominal interest rates or real interest rates? And there isn't. I mean, sometimes they go together and sometimes they go opposite. And, you know, depends on the market's mood at that moment. But in addition to that, you know, in the Middle East, in India, in Turkey, both the Turks and the Arabs make a big distinction, even though they're both, you know, Muslim countries. The Turks are very different culturally, and they make a big distinction between themselves and the Arabs and vice versa. Mm-hmm. And anyways, in all those places, not only are they buying gold like crazy, in the case of Turkey, it's because their currency is in a, you know, sort of endless free fall. But, you know, places like UAE, Bahrain, those currencies are pegged to the US dollar. They're table flat for many decades. They're not buying gold to protect themselves from falling currency. They're buying gold because they don't see currency as, number one, as inherently trustworthy. Number two, they don't. I mean, these are our nominal U.S. allies. It's not like they hate Americans. They certainly don't hate Americans. I felt very comfortable there and welcomed. They're very hospitable. They don't love U.S. foreign policy, and they don't love U.S. monetary policy. And right now, the U.S. monetary policy is giving them severe whiplash. And to maintain their peg, they have to jack up the domestic interest rate, to keep their currency being attractive. And so that plays havoc with their local businesses who are suddenly, you know, forced to deal with a much higher interest rate. And so domestic interest is thrown under the bus for, international monetary purposes. But they think of gold in a more sophisticated way. You know, it's not just buy gold, store it somewhere, wait for the price to go up and then sell it. They're thinking of it in terms of, you know, wealth planning and intergenerational wealth planning, which some Americans do, but I don't think as many. They're thinking of it as a permanent portfolio holding, which obviously the gold community thinks of it that way. But I think, 99 out of 100 Americans wouldn't have any gold at all. They wouldn't even know what the gold price was. If you said gold's $500, you said gold is $50,000, I think the average American would believe you, mm-hmm. wouldn't know. You know, I think was it, who was it who did this? Offered people a choice of either a Starbucks coffee or a 1 ounce gold coin. And they chose the Starbucks coffee because they understood that.
That was exactly the example that came to my mind as well. But I think it was like a $100 bill or a $10 bill and a gold coin or something like that.
Right. And it's like, they don't even have any idea what it is. Mm-hmm. In the Middle East, that's just, you know, the opposite of the case, but they're also using gold in more sophisticated ways. So they're putting their gold up as collateral to get dollar loans, not for consumer purposes, but to invest in other assets. They're trading gold against capital assets. I mean, just things are happening there in gold that, they're years, if not a decade ahead of us, you know, here as people, you know, bit by bit, essentially have to rediscover gold as a monetary thing rather than just purely as hedge or speculation or, you know, bet on its price. Mm-hmm. And that is absolutely going on, and it's rampant over there, and here almost unheard of. You know, you talk to sophisticated money here, and that all gold's a debt. You know, they scoff at it; they're dismissive, mm-hmm. and nobody's dismissive of gold over there.
So, do you think that that's a cultural difference, Keith? Like, where do you think that difference in understanding that particular asset comes from?
Partly cultural. You know, as I understand it, the Quran commands every good Muslim to have a certain amount of gold. You know, and then in addition, you know, places like Turkey, they've always been gaga for gold, let alone India. And of course, Dubai serves the Indian market and exports a lot of gold there. That's definitely the case. Mm-hmm. But I think also something that needs to be said, you know, we Americans, and I think Canada shares in this to a fairly high degree, we live in this incredible dollar bubble of our own making. And, you know, I'll use the analogy of the fish doesn't notice the water that it's swimming in. Mm-hmm. That's just reality to the fish. You know, to an American, you know, we have little to no awareness of other currencies. And we don't have to. The same thing with language. You know, you grew up speaking English, you can go anywhere in the world and everybody's speaking English. What an incredible privilege in a way. Mm-hmm. The rest of the world, they have to be aware of it because they're on the other end of the stick. And, you know, so there's a cultural thing, but there's also a monetary policy thing. And then to the extent that these countries have ambitions to have a divergent monetary policy to pursue other policy goals, well, they have to reckon with the dollar and the incredible roller coaster and whiplash that will be dealt to them one way or the other, especially, you know, in the Middle East, India, Turkey, they don't have a dollar swap line. As you know, I assume Canada does, the UK, Switzerland, you know, dollar swap lines, which means they don't really have the same risk of a dollar shortage versus in other places. Mm-hmm. So they get impacted by it in a different way, and that forces them to be just more conscious of it, more conscious of their own currency as well. You know, chatting with the family office there, I said, you know, your currency is table flat against the dollar, but there's always a risk that a currency peg can snap, and they do sometimes. And so therefore, if you want dollar exposure rather than to the proxy of the local currency, you're better off owning real dollars. So the principal of the family office and his advisor looked at each other, looked back at me, and he said, that's our investment strategy, exactly. To own real dollars and not own the local currency, which they don't regard, you know, as a real currency. They regard it as incidental. Like, okay, you have to do it for local transactions. You go to a restaurant, you're not paying in US dollars. Mm-hmm. But nobody of any sophistication or wealth necessarily wants to hold that local currency any more than whatever they need for immediate, you know, liquidity. And that's the non-cultural part. That's the realities of monetary policy on the ground, mm-hmm. you know, part.
So Keith, as we're thinking about, you know, all these different countries around the world, how the US dollar is seen and how that can affect all those different countries, whether it's by value, whether it's, you know, its ability to trade. You have a bit of a different view on the understanding of the rise of the BRICS nations and, let's say, the threat to the US dollar. Is that right?
Yeah, I don't see it as a threat to the dollar. The BRICS nations in particular don't love the dollar. Don't love America. Obviously, talking about Russia and China in particular, I don't know how Brazil feels about America. I think India is moving away from American orbit even more. Mm-hmm. So let's say don't love America, certainly don't love America's foreign policy, don't love America's monetary policy. And so they have expressed something that's not new. It goes back at least 60 years, which is, you know, of a love-hate relationship with the dollar, and that they would like an alternative. But, you know, expressing that you would like an alternative doesn't mean you have an alternative. And I say it's not new. The I think it was the finance minister or central bank guy under Charles de Gaulle, must have been around 1969, I think, said to Treasury Secretary Connolly, that was Nixon's Treasury Secretary, you know, your dollar is a big problem for us, because the dollar was going down at that time. And Secretary Connolly snapped back at him, well, it's our dollar, but it's your problem. Mm-hmm. Like, this is not new that, okay, we would like an alternative to the US dollar. France wanted an alternative back in those days, didn't get one. So yeah, they would love an alternative, but okay. So leaving aside the desire for an alternative, they say, okay, we're the BRICS, all for one, one for all, right? So Russia is selling oil to India, and India is one of the countries that's happy to buy Russian oil, at, especially because they get a discount. Russia cannot sell their oil at the market price that, that you and I see on the screen is at a discount because of sanctions and whatever. And they were paying Russia in rupees until Russia announced, this must be 2 or 3 weeks ago now, that, you know, India has been paying us in rupees, and now we've stacked up a whole pile of useless rupees. We're not doing that anymore. Mm-hmm. So you can't do anything with rupees. I mean, nobody outside of India wants to touch the thing. There isn't really much of a market for it. How are you going to exchange it? Other than, oh, by the way, most currency pairs, there isn't really a market to trade directly, you know, one to the other. Let's say you need New Zealand dollars and you have rupees. There's no rupee to New Zealand dollar in a market. You can go through the US dollar. So the US dollar is the intermediate good, the indirect means of exchange, even between all the other currencies. Mm-hmm. I mean, sure, if you want to trade euros for pounds sterling, yes, there's a market for that. Most of the other pairs, you know, not so much. Anyway, so Russia got sick and tired of accepting rupees. So that leads to the question, can the BRICS issue a gold-backed currency of some sort? Well, problem number one, the BRICS can't issue a currency of any sort. They're not a currency union, even more than the nations of Europe are really struggling with a currency union. But at least there is some common shared history and culture at this point. But what does Brazil have in common with India, China, and Russia? What does Russia have in common with, you know, there's nothing. So there's no way there's going to be a common currency anyways. And then secondly, I've written many times, you can't retroactively take an irredeemable currency, which was borrowed into existence with based on nothing, and declare it to be gold-backed. You know, a bank in the gold standard does not buy gold and then say, now we have enough to back a currency. A bank in the gold standard borrows gold. Who does it borrow from? It borrows from its depositors. Step one is you have to earn the trust of the depositors. So I say to people, okay, how much of your gold are you going to send to President Putin or President Xi or Lula in Brazil? How much of your gold are you going to give these guys in exchange for their piece of paper that says they'll give it back to you? Oh, you won't? So then this whole story is like the drivers that vote for light rail. They're stuck in traffic. They figure if we have light rail, all these other idiot drivers will be out of my way because they'll be taking the light rail, and now I can zip on the highway. And of course, you build the light rail is empty, the highway is still clogged with traffic, you know, during rush hour, and everyone thinks someone else will do it. Mm-hmm. Well, no one is going to send their gold to these guys. So at best, what I think you're going to see is they're going to settle their trade, deltas in gold. So, you know, India sells some stuff to Russia, Russia sells some stuff to India. If Russia sells more to India than India sells to Russia, then there will be a, balance that's due, a residual. And I think that very well could be gold, especially because Russia doesn't have a choice to take dollars. The other three countries are in the dollar world. They can take dollars and probably prefer it, but Russia probably would take their gold. So I think step one is, they're going to be shipping gold bricks to each other. The bricks are going to be sending gold bricks to each other, probably by, you know, airplane, at least at first. Then it's logical to say, what if we found a neutral jurisdiction and we can all have our gold stored there, and then all we have to do is direct the operator of the vault to change the title, maybe optionally move the pallet from one country's cage to another. Mm-hmm. And then from there, I think Monetary Metals can provide some very interesting services. Let them get a return on it while they're waiting, finance the actual trade itself. I think there's a ton of things that that they're going to want that we can do. But, they have to go through this sort of rediscover all the steps to the gold standard that countries had to discover, you know, the first time around as the world emerged out of, the Middle Ages and started to have a world economy again, how things were going to work.
Yeah, it seems like there's a lot of steps to get to that point before it's actually going to be able to happen. The only thing I wanted to ask you, Keith, is there a way of incentivizing trust and value in a type of currency other than you know, backing it with gold? Like, doesn't the amount of gold that each country holds provide the trust in which they need to see each other have in order to
It's the other way around. You know, a bank doesn't go and buy a whole bunch of gold and say, now trust us. You have to earn the trust, step one. Step two, people deposit the gold. And now you can point to the gold they have, say, look at our gold reserves. How did you get the gold reserves? People gave it to you on essentially on loan. Yeah, you buy whatever you want, but that doesn't tell us what you're going to do tomorrow. And the fact that nobody trusted you and you had to buy it tells everybody everything they need to know about trust. And, you know, and again, I emphasize these four countries are not worthy of that trust. I mean, two of them are, let's just call a spade, mass murderous dictatorships, right? In Russia, if you do something the government doesn't like, they come and kill you. In China, you know, you stand in the middle of Tiananmen Square, they run a tank over your back and shoot you full of bullets in the back. Three of those countries have capital controls. They don't trust their own people to make a withdrawal from their own currency. India, you know, China and Russia, all it's illegal to try to take money out of the country. Brazil has open capital markets. I would give them that. But Brazil just elected a hard left, you know, socialist guy. And if you want to lend money to somebody, you don't want to lend to a socialist because the socialist is thinking you're rich and the people are poor and, you know, your wealth would be spent better on the people than, you know, returning you your wealth. And so, you know, to have the kind of trust for a gold standard, it kind of implies a free market where you have the rule of law and you have the respect of right of property and the right of contract. I'm lending you, you know, you're the bank, I'm lending you 100 ounces of my gold. I don't do that unless I absolutely feel confident I'm going to get my 100 ounces back and that the law will back me every step of the way. If you, for some reason, don't feel like it or you're unable to, there has to be a well-recognized, understood for, you know, process for bankruptcy and unwinding whatever's left. I have to know where I stand in the order of precedence and getting my gold back. Otherwise, I'm not giving it to you in the first place. And I don't think any of those countries have that sort of basis of rule of law, enforceability of contract, absolute right of property. You know, there's a reason why England won, you know, in the 19th century, and it wasn't France or Germany or Italy or Spain or Netherlands or any of these other countries. And the rule of law was a big part of it. You know, if you deposit in a French bank and you're an outsider, you're an Englishman whom they didn't even like, and the bank was run by a crony of the French government, you knew what was going to happen in bankruptcy court. It was a predetermined conclusion. So why bother? And so the French banks couldn't raise the capital the English banks could raise. And then because the English banks had the capital, they were able to finance, at that time, the most capital-intensive industry that ever existed, which is railroads. Once you had the railroads, that enabled an incredible level of industrialization that the other, you know, the European powers couldn't muster because they couldn't build the railroads. And so each thing led to the next, led to the next, led to the next. And, you know, England became wealthier, but also more trusted. And the entire rest of the world would be happy to hold their gold on account in England, not the other way around. The English were not comfortable holding their gold on account in Frankfurt or Paris or Milan. It just, you know, didn't work that way.
Yeah, again, that really drives the idea of incentives home and trust on why those systems attracted that kind of capital.
That's it. And then with the capital, then all everything else is made possible.
So Keith, in the US right now, we've had, as everybody knows, this major climb in interest rates, but you shared a concept with me before we started recording here today of the bifurcation of interest rates and some of the problems that are really stemming from that right now.
Yeah. So, you know, the Fed funds rate is now, what is it, 5.25% to 5.5% is the range. And the Fed is promising at least one more hike. So, you know, in theory, 5.5% to 5.75%. That's on the Fed funds rate, which is an overnight rate. You know, you look at various maturity bonds, and the bonds generally didn't seem to want to go above that. And the longer the term, the lower the interest rate. So the whole curve is inverted, which just indicates a great deal of financial distress, you know, in the distress on the financial system. But anyways, part of that distress is that all the banks are basically insolvent because they they owned these assets, these bonds, with leverage. You know, they borrow money to buy them. And when interest rates go up, you know, bond prices are a strict mathematical inverse. Bond prices up equals, interest rates going up equals bond prices going down. So you borrow money to buy, let's say, a 10-year treasury. The 10-year treasury is down something like 22-25% from August of 2020. The 30-year treasury is down 50%. So imagine the asset side of your, you know, imagine if this was a house. You borrow $300,000, you buy a $300,000 house, and now your house is worth $150,000. What does that do to your personal net worth? And imagine if you did that at great scale and you had 100 houses that way. I mean, you'd be bankrupt, you know, 99 times over. So on top of it, the banks do this, it's called duration mismatch. They're borrowing very short-term money to buy these long-term bonds. So this is what happened to Silicon Valley Bank, is because they had some depositor withdrawals because of their unique situation, you know, it was revealed when they had to start selling the bonds that, you know, the bonds are, they're taking massive losses and you know, the whole thing is bankrupt. So I use the analogy to the Sherlock Holmes story, the dog that did not bark in the night was a key feature in this one story that Sherlock Holmes noticed somebody stole a horse and the dog wasn't barking. And therefore it had to have been somebody that was known to the dog. It was an inside job. Mm-hmm. And then you knew who the perp was. It was an outsider, the dog would be barking. You know, the dog that's not barking in the night is we haven't had any more bank runs, any more bank collapses. Why not? So what the Fed has done is they've said, okay, we will, the Fed runs, essentially, I call it a pawn shop for banks. They call it the reverse repo facility. Mm-hmm. So repo stands for purchase and repurchase agreement. So the banks are essentially selling their bonds to the Fed and then agreeing to repurchase it later. But unlike any normal repo facility and any normal pawn shop, the Fed is willing to pay the banks not today's market value on those bonds. No, whatever the bank paid for it back in 2020. So, you know, back in those days, the 10-year treasury was trading at 0.5, 0.6%. So the Fed is repoing it on the prices that correspond to 0.5, 0.6%. And that effectively means if you're a bank with all this crap on your balance sheet, the interest rate for you, unlike the rest of the market, still is pinned at 0.5, 0.6%. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, very kindly, very, very magnanimous for the Fed to give this large. No, of course, it's cheating. The Fed is cheating. This is absolutely dishonest. This is absolutely an abuse of the taxpayer and the holder of the currency. So they're offloading the market risk of the banks took by buying these bonds. They're offloading it onto the currency itself. So they're just loading more and more stress onto the currency, because they believe that essentially the currency has unlimited power to absorb unlimited amounts of the stress. And you know, you read the MMT people, modern monetary theory people, they think, oh yeah, you know, it doesn't cause inflation, it doesn't cause this, it's fine. Well, it's not fine, and it's not an unlimited, it's a very, very big number. You know, the full faith of the United States government is a much bigger number than anyone else's balance sheet and much bigger number than most people would think. It's not infinite. There is a finite, you know, level, and when you get to that, all hell's going to break loose. So this is one way they're bifurcating it. Now, Silicon Valley Bank did not have the other risk. They only had market price risk, but they own treasuries. They didn't have any default risk. The treasury's not going to default. They'll always repay in nominal terms. There's no question about that in the financial system. And no reason for the government to ever default, because every time a bond is coming due, they can always issue another one to pay it. So they can cheat that way. Anyways, but a lot of other places have default risk as well as market price risk. So the Fed has a different trick up their sleeve for this one. And so a lot of people, I'm not the only one who watches. You can look at the spread between junk bonds and treasury bonds. So how much higher is the interest rate on junk versus treasuries? And given the incredible skyrocketing of interest rates on treasuries, that spread should have blown out because there's so many zombie companies, even when rates were zero. And now that rates have gone up so much, all the zombies that were zombies are still zombies. That didn't help anybody. And now there's so many companies that didn't used to be zombies back at when interest rates were pinned at zero. Now are suddenly zombies with interest rates at 5.5% on the Fed funds rate. That spread has not blown out. I mean, if you look at a long-term graph of it, you see a giant spike in 2008, as you'd expect. You see a lesser but still pretty giant spike in 2020 with the onset of COVID and the lockdown. And then they tamp it back down. And since then, there's really, that's another dog that isn't barking in the night. There's nothing going on in that spread, but there should be. Mm-hmm. I mean, all these junk borrowers couldn't afford their debt service, even at zero interest rates now, let alone where they are today. And why is the credit market so incredibly forgiving? So I've had a couple of conversations, both offline with a investor of ours who's in, you know, selling insurance as part of his business. And then a bit of a conversation, we had Bob Elliott on our podcast. Was it last week or the week before? And it turns out that if you're an insurance company or running an annuity, you know, there's leverage on the balance sheet. The regulators want you to reserve a certain amount of capital for each asset that you own, and the amount of capital you have to reserve depends on the quality of the asset. So if you're buying treasury bonds, you don't need to reserve a lot of capital because you're not taking any risk of capital loss. If you're buying junk bonds, they want you to reserve a lot more capital because some of those junk bonds are going to default. That's why it's called junk. So what the regulators are doing now, the picture that I have, and Bob said that what I said, you know, confirmed things he's hearing informally, is that the regulators are saying, hey, you know all that capital that you're supposed to reserve when you own junk bonds? Well, we can dispense with that. We're not going to bother with that right now. Mm-hmm. Kind of like, you know, you don't have to mark the losses on your balance sheet when bond prices go down. You can just call it hold to maturity. So it's an accounting fiction that gives insurance companies and annuity, you know, usually annuities are offered by insurance companies. It gives them the leeway to lever up and buy junk bonds with more leverage than they used to. And the reason why they do this is that everybody's balance sheet is impaired with this incredible drop in bond prices. They have to find a way to recapitalize. Now, junk bonds are trading at a 3.8% interest rate premium to comparable treasury. So instead of getting 5.5, you're getting 9 or, you know, 9 point something. So you're recapitalizing your balance sheet faster by accumulating interest at that rate and hoping that the system will hold together and you're not going to have another 2008. So the regulators have encouraged this by being, I'll call it, aggressively indifferent to, you know, principles of sound at balance sheet management for an asset manager, really. And so those two things, if there's those two things that are occurring that I know about, to point to, there must be other places that are going on in all the hidden dark corners of everybody's balance sheet that I just don't know about. And it's not like I'm a forensic investigator digging into this anyway. I have a full-time job. But essentially, they've bifurcated the interest rate, and they've allowed certain corners of the financial system to act, and more importantly, trade and write their balance sheet as if we were still in a zero interest rate environment. But most of the rest of us have to reckon with a 5.5% environment. So they've bifurcated the interest rate. Now, this is a really dangerous thing. It's like opening a fissure up. You're walking on a grassy plain, all this, you know, the ground shakes, and there's this fissure that opens up, and you look down and you see, you know, infernal fires down below, and then it's getting wider and wider and wider. Like, what the hell is going on? It's a very dangerous thing that you could disrupt everything in ways that aren't at all obvious up front. And so I liken this to the Fed is, you know, a bunch of children sitting there in a dry hayloft playing with matches. I don't think they have the slightest idea what they do with this kind of stuff. They're just making it up as they go along. Each thing that they do precipitating the next leg of the crisis. And all the only thing that they understand is in 2008, the Fed was asleep at the helm. This time around, they're going to be hyper proactive and not allow anything to happen. So the slightest thing that starts to erupt, they're just, it's like a giant game of whack-a-mole, and they have you know, 20 hands and 20 mallets, and everything that's popping up, they're just whacking it. And
well, it reminds me of your pinned tweet, right? The underappreciated idea of the Austrian school, that the damage is done during the boom. The bust does not destroy wealth. It's just the accounting catching up to the reality.
That's right. And now this is more damage as they try to prolong the boom, at least for certain cronies, you know, big insurance companies and banks. They're trying to prolong the boom times while the rest of us get to take their bitter medicine of a bust. Mm-hmm. And, you know, how do you manage that? How do you bifurcate that and get, you know, who knows? That's going to create 100 more things that we'll be talking about for many more podcast episodes to come.
Yeah.
As these things unfold and blow up in various ways that are very hard to predict.
Yeah. It seems like, you know, a juicy steak thrown in the corner for the dogs to keep them occupied and not alert to the horse thief, right?
That's right. Dogs aren't barking because they're chowing down on steak. Mm-hmm. That's right.
So Keith, you've recently written a series on the anti-concepts of money. And I think this is a great way to understand some of these ideas and see where they might be wrong to revisit them. So why are anti-concepts so deadly, and how can they be deliberately used to confuse or obfuscate reality?
So I have to start out on what I assume is more familiar ground. Most people that are in the gold space probably at least have some libertarian leanings. And so if a socialist comes up to you and says all work is exploitation, essentially work, you know, job equals slavery, it's pretty easy to kind of argue back and say, no, you know, a slave is chained, mm-hmm. you know, under threat of a whip or a gun ultimately, and a job you're not. And so you have a defense mechanism against somebody making an assertion, which is wrong. So what an anti-concept does is it smuggles that premise, but in a more implicit way. And so, you know, they define, you know, work as exploitation or something like that. It's kind of hidden. And then if you argue against it, they can say, but look at the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. Look at child trafficking. Look at, you know, the slavery in China and all these places. And it's true. I mean, the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory did happen. And they locked the door shut. People weren't able to leave. And so 100 and something people died. And I don't know how many injuries there were. It must have been a lot more than that. That's true. You can't argue against it by saying that the proposition is false. You have to say what you're doing is you're lumping together two dissimilar things. One is slavery and the other is a voluntary win-win relationship. Mm-hmm. If I come to somebody and say, I'll give you a job, I want you to do this work for me, and in exchange, I'm going to pay you this amount of money. Well, that's win-win. I mean, if it wasn't win-win, you'd say no. Mm-hmm. So you can't lump that together with slavery, which is I'm putting a gun to your head, slapping, you know, chains on you and say, now work. And if you don't work, I'm going to beat you and I'm not going to feed you. Right? Those are two opposite things, but they get lumped together in the same thing by this pernicious and sort of deadly anti-concept. So that's what we have in the area of money, is all the important concepts that matter. You know, George Orwell figured this out. If the government can control the definitions of all the words, at least the ones that matter, then nobody can even think against the government. Thinking against the government becomes almost impossible. So how do they define money? They define money as a medium of exchange. And, you know, in the article I talk about, I cite some definitions, and it was, you know, a monetary value or claim to monetary value. And I just tear it apart and say, imagine if we were treating, if you go to a fancy restaurant and it's cold in the winter and it's freezing rain outside, you're wearing a coat. You take off your coat and you give it to the clerk at the coat closet and you get a coat check receipt. Imagine if we were treating the coat check receipt and the coat as if they were the same thing and use the same word. And we use the word coat to refer to both of them. And then, you know, to make an analogy to our monetary system, suppose the restaurant goes out of business 50 years ago and all the coats are liquidated, or, you know, they raise the building and they put up a brand new condo or something like that. All the coats are gone. And we're still trading these things that we call coats that are just little 50-year-old slips of paper that say, you know, receipt number 1234. And we're trading those slips as if they were coats. Now, in the case of coats, nobody would be fooled because the coat is supposed to keep you warm. And in the case of money, people are fooled because they don't realize that what money is supposed to do is supposed to be the final payment, the final extinguisher of debt, but it's been redefined as a medium of exchange. And the Kochek receipts work reasonably well. Actually, they work really well as a medium of exchange. They don't work so well as a final payment, which they're not, or as a store of value, which they're not. And so in the series, I look at all the words used around money today. Mm-hmm. Look at why, from a conceptual level, why they're wrong or not even wrong, why they're making category errors in how they approach things. I love the term purchasing power, and what's the purchasing power of that currency? And so every time on Twitter, I'm probably a lot of people annoyed with me for doing this, but so be it. Every time someone's talking about some insane prices in California, I'm like, that's odd. The purchasing power of the California dollar has fallen quite a lot compared to the purchasing power of the Arizona dollar. And the point I'm trying to make, sarcastically though it may be, is that it's the same dollar, but most people believe Milton Friedman is that inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. How do you explain that inflation in California, if you want to call this inflation, which I don't, which is another anti-concept of money, how do you explain that inflation has been so much worse in California than in Arizona? Unless you want to talk about useless ingredients, green energy restrictions, principally of those, two non-monetary forces that California has wielded against its productive businesses more than Arizona has. So the prices are higher. And purchasing power implies that the ability to buy something is intrinsic to the currency. It's kind of like, when I was a kid, I don't know if I said this or my brother said this, but I must have been 2 years old and my brother was under a year. I was 2.5 and he was, a year or something like that. About the idea there are little men in the TV. And, which is a naive, it's a naive assumption for a child and very acute the kid thinks there's people in the TV, right? People think that there's purchasing intrinsic in the currency and not realizing that currency just trades for goods. And, the good supply has everything to do with who can produce them and how much they can produce. And it's not intrinsic to the currency. And if you come along and wipe out the energy supply, as Europe did, then you can see the price of energy skyrocket 10x. And if energy goes up 10x, then everything else is going to go up, massively. And it's nothing to do with ECB printing money. So the series is an attempt to show people the category errors and the sort of wrongfully formed, thoughts around money and how the government has deliberately propagated these, rationally unusable ways of thinking, because they all reinforce the government's paradigm, which is we have a irredeemable currency that we're forced to use for our own good. And then, they administer the interest rates and everything else allegedly for our own good. And yet they're actually, we're the ones getting screwed. Mm-hmm. So the victims are voting for this because they believe it defeats their own good. That's the thing that really makes this so. I think there's a number of people now that are starting to observe something, which is this idea that, wait, your way of killing inflation is to cause people to be unemployed? Like, isn't there a moral problem with this? I mean, let alone, is it even true anyway? Mm-hmm. What is wrong with the whole paradigm that this is how people think? And anyways, these wrongfully defined, concepts, contribute to that.
Well, right in that line of thinking, Keith, should we try to, let's say, define more succinctly the term inflation? I think we can be talking past each other, or not necessarily us, but on the internet or wherever. The term inflation can either be referring to the money supply and or consumer price inflation. So should we really be kind of drilling down into those definitions as well?
Yeah, and I argue both of those definitions are wrong. Mm-hmm. The first interesting litmus test in the gold standard is gold mining inflation. Mm-hmm. If you want to argue gold mining is inflation, I just say, well, look, we got to part company because this doesn't make any sense to me. There's something dishonest about inflation. That's, and gold mining is an honest trade. People value this as metal. You're finding more of it. That's good. That's not bad. Mm-hmm. My definition of inflation It's the counterfeiting of credit. It's a monetary fraud. It's borrowing without the means or intent, and in some cases, the knowledge or consent of the lender. But certainly the borrower has neither means nor intent to repay, but they call it borrowing. It's kind of like your kid says, hey, Dad, can I borrow $1,000? And you're like, what the hell do you need $1,000 for, number one? And number two, how are you going to repay it? And it says, oh, well, I need it to buy a new iPhone. And you're like, okay, that's nice. And how are you going to repay it? And he's like, well, I'll find a way. You're like, this doesn't sound like this is going to go anywhere good. So no, until you have a clear repayment plan, I'm not lending you $1,000. Mm-hmm. You can ask for one as a gift for Christmas, and maybe I'll give you one, but I'm not lending $1,000 because it isn't lending, right? And you're not going to repay me. And that's what the government does. And so that's inflation to me. Deflation is a forcible contraction of credit because it's the inevitable outcome when somebody borrows without means to repay. That means they're not going to repay. Mm-hmm. When you get close to that moment, you either get a default and a bankruptcy, or you get a special kind of negotiation with the lender that is colloquially called a cram down. There may not actually be a default, but the lender has agreed to take something less than what he was owed, because that's all he's going to get, right? There's, you know, the borrower doesn't have any more. So that's what I would call inflation and deflation. And notice that divorces it from any idea of the consumer price index, because inflation can cause falling consumer prices. If you get an incredible malinvestment in hamburger restaurants, the price of a hamburger is going to go down, not up. So, you know, the concept of inflation and the concept of rising prices are not intrinsically linked anyway.
I was going to say, if you can define what ends up being the end product as a hamburger by the end as well.
Right.
Well, Keith, I know we're coming up against time here. I really appreciate this conversation today. Is there anything you'd like to add before we wrap up?
I mean, you know, I hate to keep harping on, let's say, the gold standard, but the whole point of it is, if the person who's the saver is in charge of things, and he's in charge because he can pull his savings at any time in the gold standard, in the paper standard, you're captive, you're disenfranchised. There's really no such thing as withdrawal. I mean, you can take paper out of the bank, but then they're just notes issued by the Federal Reserve. So you're funding the Federal Reserve, who's going to then fund the banks and the government anyway. So, but if the saver is in charge, that forces the entire financial system to be honest, because any dishonest institution is going to find itself stripped of its funding in short order. Mm-hmm. Just like any restaurant that served crap food, any store that, you know, sold crap merchandise, any doctor that killed all his patients, you know, they find themselves going out of business. And so the fundamental feature of the gold standard isn't, do we have rising consumer prices or not? It's, do you have honesty in financial dealings or not? The issue of gold credit can't cheat in the way that issuers of paper irredeemable credit, you know, today can cheat. And that's, you know, hopefully that gets people to think about the gold standard in a different light. And it's a much more important issue. I mean, inflation is a statistic. Joseph Stalin said, you know, if you kill one person, that's a tragedy. If you kill a million people, that's a statistic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, statistics are very antiseptic and just, you know, who cares in a way? Well, now if we're talking about honesty and fair dealings, that's a much more human, much more relatable thing, and it has a much greater degree of importance to the human condition. Do you want a system where they're empowered to cheat, or do you want a system where the saver is ultimately in charge, and if the saver doesn't feel that he's being treated fairly, just pulls his gold. Mm-hmm. That's ultimately the vision that I had in the Gold Standard Institute. That's what Monetary Metals is trying to work towards, is re-empower the saver, who really ought to be in charge. It's your money. You worked hard. You spent some of your money on living. The rest you kept. And in order for that not to be a pointless sacrifice, that money has to be yours and be able to work for you. And that's what's possible uniquely about the gold standard.
Yeah, absolutely. And hopefully the incentives of that system continue to attract more people, because ultimately that's why we're all here. That's why we're all investing in gold and saving for a rainy day instead of just spending and, you know, relying on the Fed to come bail everyone out again.
Right. If you're buying gold today, whether you realize it or not, I think most people do, you're opting out of the banking system. Mm-hmm. You're saying, no, bro, I'm all good. Thanks. I want to, at least for this portion, and for most people, I think it's single-digit percentage of their portfolio, but for that portion of the portfolio, I want to opt out. I'm going to take my marbles and leave the sandbox. Mm-hmm. And of course, they don't want you to do that. They want you all in. But as long as gold is legal to possess, you have that right. And, you know, people are availing themselves of that to protect themselves. They see the train wreck that's coming and, you know, want to avoid those losses.
Mm-hmm. Of course, Keith, your series on the anti-concepts of money is available at monetarymetals.com.
Monetary-metals, there's a dash there.
Right, sorry. And it's a really interesting read. You have a couple of videos there explaining some of the concepts as well. And of course, at Real Keith Wiener on Twitter, right?
That is my Twitter handle.
Perfect. Keith, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate you really diving really deep into these concepts for us.
Thanks for having me, Tom. This is fun.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.